Hey, everybody, welcome to Co-Pilots. I am Sean Conroy.
And I'm Andy Secunda.
On this podcast, we talk about TV pilots, the first episodes of television shows. Sometimes pilots become long-running series. Others don't make it past that first episode.
We're going to talk about all of them. The great pilots, the bad pilots, the weird pilots, the forgotten pilots. We are TV writers, but it should be noted that we are the dumbest TV writers you know. So all these are just our dumb opinions.
So dumb. So our first pilot that we want to talk about debuted on September 25th, 1999. And just to give you some pop culture context of what else was going on at that time, the number one song in the country at that time, your favorite, Unpretty by TLC. You love that song. You always. I
mean, some might say that was my personal theme song.
Uh-huh. In movie theaters, people were watching Being John Malkovich, American Beauty, Fight Club. This was back when other people made movies besides Marvel, so there were interesting movies to see.
Not a complainer about the Marvel trend, just to give everybody a heads up where I stand on that. I know that's the popular stance right
don't
now.
Don't care for it. Serena Williams had just won her first Grand Slam. My understanding is that she went on to win several more over the next few years.
So I've heard.
And in television, 3 days before this show debuted, another show debuted called West Wing, which became popular, did well.
Yeah.
Got extended for a number of seasons, unlike the show we're about to talk about. So the pilot we wanted to talk about today is Freaks and Geeks. And it is, I guess I'll just get into what goes on in the show. Is that?
Well, to table set a little bit.
Yeah.
Obviously, just renowned show. Well thought of.
Listed in a lot of top 50 TV shows of all time. Top 100. Top 1,000. Like, you make a list of top shows, this is on a lot of them.
Without question. And the bigger you make that number, the more likely Freaks and Geeks is going to be.
I saw a list of the top 10,000. It was not on that list.
Interesting. So. It's so fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, if you ask Judd Apatow, or really most people inside the industry, was not treated the way it probably should have been treated in terms of promotion, consistency of airings, and so never really found an audience and was canceled halfway through the first season. And that adds to its legend. The sort of the background of how it came to be, and these kind of things always fascinate me, was that Scott Sassa was the West Coast NBC president. He was more from the business side, and so I don't know the details other than some of the oral histories and Judd Apatow sort of speaking about it, but it's like he basically was the interim president, kind of did not have the creative background as an executive that other
he was kind of a unicorn in terms of executives there. I mean, if you have the Scott Sassa trading card, it's worth quite a bit these days.
That's right. Great RBI though.
Yeah.
And so as a result, this is kind of one of those situations which you can point to many examples, Mad Men being a perfect example of like where there's a weird situation going on behind the scenes with the network at the executive level. And that is the reason this very unusual show in terms of everything, casting, tone, somehow gets on mainstream network TV. And Shelley McCrory, who was development executive at NBC, basically, according to legend, said, if this show doesn't get on, I'm leaving the business. And Scott Sassa, who was sort of just new to the situation, was like, well, I don't know, I'm not sure, I'm just figuring this out, so sure, all right, let's put it on. And you know, they were like, well, we want to cast in this sort of unusual way. And Scott Sassa was like, great. Whereas usually it's like, no, we have to go through this rigorous thing, these are the lists, these are the people that are acceptable, we want you to bring you several options, which they had to do anyway. But it's like everything about this process was unusual, which is why it is one of the most atypical shows for even 1999, which was theoretically kind of the dawn of
the golden age of television.
Right. Or the second.
This is why I love
age.
Talking to you about this stuff, because in my notes, all it says is like, I liked it. It was good. And you have like a whole breakdown of how the show got made.
Right.
Which is extensive.
Which, as I said in the past, and I will say again, just don't get used to that. That's
it's not going to happen every time.
No, this one is one where there's a tremendous amount of material,
right?
And I've only poked on the surface, so usually it's just going to be us, Sean and I, saying, "Hey, that thing I saw,
that was good. I liked it."
But yeah, it was
a lot of things had to come together for it to work out the way it did.
And there's a systemic uphill battle in all forms of where, you know, commerce meets art, but particularly in network television, where it's just there's so many rigid structures. And this was a very unusual situation where it was allowed to be as fluid and creative, or closer to fluid and creative, until the point when they canceled it halfway through the season.
Right.
So that's basically just sort of the...
Have you read the pilot script?
I have not.
It's very different from what was shot.
Now, I wonder, is the pilot script, because what I know had happened, Apatow and Paul Feig were friends. Feig was just
Feig wrote the pilot, gave it to Judd. Judd sold it to Scott
DreamWorks,
Sasser or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah.
He had a deal at DreamWorks, yes. Right. And they pitched it around, they sold it. And yeah, and his original script that the network apparently had shockingly no notes. They were just like, yeah, great, go and shoot this.
Right.
And so then Judd was the one, and I guess Jake Kasdan, who was the only 24, had only done Zero Effect. Judd Apatow had not even seen Zero Effect before he hired him. Just the greatest luck in the universe that he got the perfect tone to make this. They both were like, all right, like, now let's tear this apart. Paul Feig, you know, self-admitted control freak, was like, what are we doing? And they just went through it. And so I wonder if that one that you read is his original draft.
I think it is. I think it's the original draft. And I won't go through it beat by beat. I'll just talk about it in the cold open when we get to that. But it is interesting to see, like, they took so much out and you really didn't need it, you know? And different things happen in different order and whatever. But
right.
I'm always fascinated by that, where people have this very clear idea of what they want to do in a pilot, and then it becomes a collaborative process, and there's so many voices involved that things sort of go in a lot of different directions. And I think that speaks to what you're saying about network television, that if it's the right people and they hit it the right way, it can be great. And if not, it just screws everything up.
Right. And look, I'm going to be saying, if we continue to make this podcast, somebody's saying a lot of kind of salty things about the industry and the system and how difficult it is to make a pure sort of thing that you're like, this is what feels right intuitively and creatively, because of exactly what Sean is saying. There's so many voices. There's so many people serving different masters, and there's so much money involved that, from just a reasonable perspective, you know, it's like, I mean, I get it from an executive perspective. You have to answer to your masters. Your job is on the line. There's a tremendous amount of pressure. And so you have to defend everything that you allow to get past, whether it be casting or any shot. And so that's why there's such what I would call a stranglehold on most of the creative process. But of course, that's not, you know, advantageous to any creative process, because even if you're left to your own devices, making something fantastic is incredibly difficult.
Right. And that's why when I write, I choke myself the entire time, because I want
to
get used to the
retain a stranglehold,
the stranglehold
on himself.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that kind of gives him the fire to kind of overcome his own.
Makes me more productive.
Right. I only do that to myself emotionally.
By the way, this show will be very sad.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
That is another guarantee.
Yeah.
Why don't we get into it? I'm sure there are other things that I'm going to, as we go, I'm going to go, oh, here's another tidbit.
Okay. So we come in on a typical high school, William McKinley High, which, of course, I'm always like, why did they call it McKinley? McKinley was assassinated, the 25th president, assassinated in 1901. So
sure.
It feels like there's a connection there.
It's your favorite assassinated president, right, John?
Second favorite. I loved Lincoln. last president to fight in the Civil War, William McKinley, was a soldier in the Civil War.
Really?
Yeah.
Which side?
The right side. Let's just leave it at that. The right side.
Sean tries to stay away from hot button political topics. So.
So it's fall of 1980. Mm-hmm. We know it's fall because there's football practice going on, and we know that that's when football practice happens. And we see a cheerleader and a football player in the stands. They're having a conversation about romance. It's very serious, very intense. Then we go down underneath the stands and we meet the freaks, or at least some of them.
What's amazing right off the bat
mm-hmm.
to me watching this again, as I've seen it several times, is it's like they accomplish exactly what Paul Feig has later said they were aiming for, which is like the two attractive cheerleader and football player is like, and the tone of the conversation they're having, that's like the WB show at the time with all the beautiful young people.
Right.
And they're sort of going away from them, and they're going beneath the
stands.
Who
else is there?
The outsiders, and that's who we're going to focus on.
Right.
Just immediately, first 60 seconds.
Well, that's what I was thinking when I was reading the pilot script. The pilot script is way longer, with way more dialogue, way more exposition.
Interesting.
Who are these people? All that stuff. And they do it, and it strikes me because, and not to brag, I did direct a short film last year, and
here
I wrote
go.
All kinds of stuff. And then you shoot it and you cut everything because right. you don't need it, because it's a visual medium, and your brain is like, I got to say this and this and this. I got to put this in and this in. And then you just see it. And even with casting choices, you don't need to say anything, because you just look at one of the people and you're like, I know exactly who that person is.
And since you're off on this topic, Allison,
don't blame me, but
I mean, since you just led us into this weird blind alley, might as well just follow it, I guess.
All right.
Allison Jones, obviously legendary.
She's one of the stars of Barry, I believe, right?
Is she? I didn't see
She's seen actually it. In it.
That's
yeah.
amazing. Yeah. Legendary casting agent. Just such, you know, I've been cast by her, and I've just such an eye that is displayed here at just like in a way that is unparalleled in television history. And a lot of it was, I mean, even from Allison Jones's own admission, I think the way they were casting this, she was like, oh, we can do this. You want us to do this, which is they had just some sides that they just wrote up that weren't in the script. And they just saw every kid in the world and saw, all right, well, who has a voice? Who has a specific quality? Who has, you know, who is the character or immediately communicates a specific rhythm? And that was how they found these just gems that almost all, look at that opening shot. Everyone has become
a star,
a major star for good reason.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, for Martin Starr, it was because his name was Starr.
He had the leg up, for sure. And then what they did is they retrofitted the script to basically play on the things that were already in that actor's rhythm and voices and tone. And it's just like, I have so many times tried to reverse engineer from like, okay, let's either start with the actor,
mm-hmm.
let's cast the actor, or if we're going to have the actors, let's cast the actors. And then, you know, and I usually do try to adjust in situations where I've had pilots. But if it's like the first version, the system doesn't want to do that, because then they can't retain, you know, a hold on. No, this is our list. These are the people. We're just going to put them in.
These guys have star power.
Exactly. Or they're popular at the moment, even though they're not going to be popular a season
TikTok
from
followers.
Now. I mean, now that is what it is. Yeah. Or on the flip side, you're usually locked a little bit to what the network has agreed to, or the studio, or whoever you're dealing with. So it's like you only have so much room to maneuver changing the script to match the voice or the story. And this was a case where they could do it perfectly, and it shows on the screen. Like, these are kids. Like, some of them, like Martin Starr, apparently, because it's very hard to tell based on the pilot, like, it was this who Martin Starr was at this moment?
Right.
Or, and from everything I've read, it's like, he wasn't. He wasn't Bill.
Mm-hmm.
He just had the knack. He knew how to play that guy.
Right.
Whereas John Francis Daly, as Sam, was more like, that was how he kind of communicated.
Right.
And it's just like, it shows on the screen, that process. It just like, every character is alive immediately. And to your point, you immediately kind of know who they are when you see them. Before they say anything, without exposition.
Right. Well, so that's what I was going to say, is in the script, the whole scene with the geeks, who we meet after we meet the freaks, they're outside the auditorium. They're talking about how they were just building sets for the theater. And, you know, the classic, like, these are the fucking nerds from high school. And you don't need any of that, because you just look at those kids and you know who they are. You
right.
know? So anyway, we meet them. Then we meet the bully who's going to beat up Sam.
Right.
And he's not a nice person. By the way, in case you're just joining us, we're 2 hours into the show and we're in the cold open right now.
get used to it. One thing that's it's also they immediately introduced Thomas F. Wilson, who's Biff from Back to the Future.
Yes, he's the just first person you see on screen.
The immediate, what a how much more inspired could you get as the gym coach? It's such a gimme.
Yeah,
and yet it's like you start with like, oh, he's going to be the Biff guy, and he is the Biff guy, and as in keeping with what the show does down the line. And then he's later humanized, and there's his relationship with Bill. It's just such a...
Well, I think one of the things that stood out to me when I watched the pilot these last couple times is how much of it is about who is on your side when you're that age.
Right.
And it's no one, basically.
Right. And what's interesting even in that scene is there are two things that are amazing. The first thing is that when the bully starts getting in Sam's face, the two friends immediately turn away and pretend, just dissociate there. It is not happening. Right. They eject from that situation and abandon him immediately. Mm-hmm. It's so real.
Yeah.
And just like...
Well, because they don't want to be noticed. Like, that's the worst thing you can do is call attention to yourself in that situation.
Of course. Yeah. I think Sam Levine says... What is... I don't remember. I'll get to the quote later. But he has a hilarious quote that his father says, which is just like, don't get involved. That's what, my dad tells me to stay out of fights that don't affect me directly. So amazing. And then on the flip side of that, Linda Cardellini, just, it's interesting the breakdown of the people like John Francis Daly, who are kind of like, their strength is their awkwardness and their lack of polish. And that,
well, the way he looks, his face, his eyes, the
right.
entire time,
yes.
are saying so much about like, what the fuck is going on right now?
And what struck me about this in this viewing is his eyes are saying it all, and yet his face seems like it's like, you can't, like, that is not an actor's face where he's polished. Oh, I know I can do this. And I hit my angles this way, whatever. His face looks like it's off in its own universe, mm-hmm. as many of the people in the show. I think it, to a certain degree, like some of the adults too. Like, there's people like Joe Flaherty who are like obviously comedy, you know, just heavy hitters, but not like actors that are like have this total like, you know, laser focus control that it's just like it's they're not giving a polished performance, and that in some ways is what breathes life into the show, is like it gives it this weird hyper almost neorealism, Italian neorealist kind of vibe, right. of like these are real, are we watching real people?
Well, I mean, Joe Flaherty in particular stands out to me as somebody who feels like a cartoon character a lot of the time in this, until Lindsay just snaps and goes like, what are you talking about?
Which grounds it. And so to circle back to Linda Cardellini.
Yeah. By the way, now we're 3/4 of the way through the pilot.
And so then at the end, when Becky Ann Baker is another one playing her mom. And I'll get to her in a moment. But Linda Cardellini, who has a similar vibe, which is that they have more of a feeling of like trained, controlled performances. Mm-hmm. That are like certainly, you know, emotional and they're inhabiting their characters, but are just like, that's more of a person that's like, okay, well, that's going to be our we're seeing the world mostly through her eyes because that's the most crafted performance.
Right.
And so it's interesting to see her as the, you could argue, the heart of the show in comparison to these people around her that feel like it's just like, oh, this woman was dropped into this real high school somehow.
Right. So she scares the bully away.
Right.
And
which is another thing, sorry again.
Yeah.
Which is another thing to the point of like people the friends go away, and then the second point I was gonna make, the sister tries to help, which is you're on her side.
Right.
And it has a negative effect.
Which is thematically what happens to her throughout the episode. Right. Every time she tries to fix something, she makes it worse.
Right. Which is the experience of high school.
Right.
And like
she's
even if
never
you have
right
good.
About anything. She's
right.
always wrong.
So
in this case,
beautiful.
It's when she says like to insult Alan, she says the thing about you only fight people who weigh less than 100 pounds, and Sam is mad at the end. He's like, I actually weigh 103 pounds, and he walks away.
And the delivery is like I'm saying, he's just like. By the way, I weigh 103 pounds. It's just like barely a delivery, and that like makes you lean in and like.
Okay, so we come out of that. We go into the credit sequence, which is one of my favorite credit sequences of all time.
Just isn't it amazing that sort of just like the success of certain credit sequences like that? That says everything you need to know about every character. like Sam Levine giving the cheesy like one smile.
One of the things I've become very aware of with streaming services, because you can skip the credit sequence, you just don't have to watch it.
Yeah.
Is like, which credit sequences will I watch when I'm watching a show?
And this is obviously a definite.
I think it's one of the best ones.
And one of the things that is also interesting is the spirit of the show is so, I feel like, what's FYI, what's going to happen with me in these podcasts is I'm talking a lot at the top and then I'll tire myself out, you right. know, like a prize fighter.
There is coffee over there, just so you know.
And then Sean will win at the end, you know, when you, after I'm done rope-a-doping.
Andy's
myself.
On the floor over here, folks, and I'm still going. I just wanted to point that out.
I can get back to the mic. Give me one more second.
Get back up there, Andy. You can do it, kid.
In terms of the credit sequence, the Joan Jett bad reputation thing mm-hmm. is sort of antithetical to the spirit of the show, which is we're going to be concentrating on the losers and the nerds. Whereas that song is so sets such a cool tone, contrary to the images we're seeing of the people. And to me, that is like the show saying, "Yes, we're focusing on the losers, but this show is going to be the coolest thing you've ever seen."
Right. And to your point, they did clearly spend a lot of money on the soundtrack for this episode. I don't know if that's consistent throughout the series, but
you think Styx was really playing hardball?
Well, Van Halen at the beginning.
That's true.
And that was you know, like Van Halen has never gone away. You
right.
know what I mean? Like, that sure, you can shit on Styx all you want.
I love Styx. I got no problem. The other thing is just about the credit sequence for Offit is down to the choice of the font, which obviously became iconic, and you instantly think about that show when you see it,
uh-huh.
is like, that is such an attention to detail that to me said is the creators saying, you're in good hands. We're yeah. looking at everything, which is interesting for a show that's like, there's very little incidental music, almost right. to the point where it's disturbing.
Right. Okay, so we come out of that. We go into dinner with Mom and Dad. There's a couple things. Well, the thing I love the most about the scene, first of all, I should establish that I was exactly the age of these kids at that time.
Right.
Like, I was Sam's age in 1980.
Right. Well, I'm far younger than
yeah,
Sean.
Yeah, you're way younger than I am. And you were Sam's age in 2004.
That's right, yes. Yeah. I've aged very poorly.
But the moment where he tells his father he's so excited about seeing Monty Python and the Holy Grail, that was my relationship with my parents.
And like, what's his response to
just say? Baffled. Like, I don't understand what you're even talking about.
That,
you know?
To me, is one of Joe Flaherty's
yeah.
best,
he kind of plays along, but he clearly is just like,
it's yeah, it's
what
not,
do you even mean?
That's why I like, it's not full cartoon character, because it's not like, what are you talking about? I don't need to hear
no,
it.
No,
it's just
he
like,
tries to be nice
polite.
About it. Yeah,
it's just like, I don't know what you're talking yes. about, and I don't care. But
well, that's the whole thing, is I do not care. I have right. no interest in what you're saying.
But
right
he's not
now.
Being a dick about
no,
it.
No. He just doesn't care. And then, of course, it comes out that that Lindsay has to go to the homecoming dance. She has right. no choice. Then we come into the lunchroom. There's a great Tribble joke.
Love
which
it.
Which is always a fun Star Trek reference.
And this is, I'm sure anyone who's dug into the history knows this story. But Sam Levine, who's hilariously of, you've met Sam Levine?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Of all the people.
Well, he used to be around the UCB theater a lot back in the early days out here
right.
on
which
Franklin.
If you haven't specified, that's how Sean and I know each other. He
Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, the renowned dominating comedy force of the early 21st century.
When he auditioned, they would look at his audition, and they were sort of like, okay, well, that's, you know, it's a solid audition. And then the casting people are like, well, wait until the end. And at the end, he's like, can I do it now? And he went into his Shatner impression. They're like, oh, okay, this is the guy. It was like,
he
oh,
was
that,
that guy.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And he is when you meet him in life to a certain
yeah.
degree.
Yeah. Super nice guy. So again, I just love the scene, because it is that dread of walking into the lunchroom. And am I going to find the people I'm going to be able to sit with?
Sure.
That moment of indecision. And then we see Alan again in this scene.
The bully.
Bullying Sam.
Chauncey LaParty, who is in The Sandlot.
Okay, I don't know all their names.
I don't, okay, I'm not pressuring
and
you,
we
Sean.
See
you can do whatever you need.
Eli, who is a kid with special needs, played by the great, great actor Ben Foster. Known from 310 to Yuma, Alpha Dogs,
Hell and High Water,
Last Stand, X-Men Last Stand. I mean, we could go on and on.
We sure could.
But this is a weird
possum on this one. I was like, oh, I thought he was going to make up credits because he didn't care about it. Ben Foster, he's got a real.
Yeah, no, I love Ben Foster. He's amazing. And
you want to marry Ben Foster?
Not marry, just have sex with. If you're listening, Ben, I'm available. But you know, he's playing a kid with special needs, which. Of course, you could never do that now. Like, it would be...
So that I agree with you. But in terms of the performance itself, I think it's like, I don't know. I feel like it succeeds on a level. It's not patronizing to the character.
No.
I was impressed immediately, and I'd forgotten how much he was in the pilot.
Yeah.
That I was like, oh, that's a fantastic one-off little characterization.
Right. So. Yeah, he is very important to the pilot all the way through. So then Lindsay, we cross and Lindsay meets up with Daniel and goes out to the smoking patio and we're back with the geeks. Oh, and I should say in the cold open, there's a moment where Lindsay is watching the freaks and she just clearly is yearning to be a part of that group, which you can tell because she's wearing an army jacket. Like that is the dead giveaway of like she belongs with the burnouts.
Sure.
You know,
which is a side note, another genius element to this show that is so atypical both in that time and in this time is you're dressing your female lead in a baggy army jacket.
Yeah.
Never would be done.
Right.
Never would be allowed.
So we get that she wants to be part of that group. She's not part of the group. She runs into Daniel in the lunchroom and goes with him out to the smoking patio.
Right.
Which is a big deal, clearly, in her mind. She's trying to play it cool.
Right.
But she can't believe she's going to go to the smoking patio.
Although, one interesting aspect that is also atypical is there's a little bit of a vibe, and I think they went through different versions of how far in it was in terms of her relationship to the burnouts, but that she does, they don't have to go through the thing of her meeting Daniel and whatever. It's like they know each other.
Right.
This is the first moment she's sort of invited out,
right.
Which is a perfect storytelling way to shortcut it just enough, but we also see enough of the introduction.
Establishment
which I think
of the relationship.
An adjustment that Paul Feig did.
I mean, that's a big thing in pilots, right? Is you have the new person coming in who doesn't know anybody, and that's how we get all the exposition of this is this person. But it's done so subtly in this that you don't have to have all that stuff.
Have you ever... Sean, I mean, I can't even think.
Yes, Andy?
Have you ever said a smart thing in your entire life? Have you ever seen a pilot with as little spoken exposition?
It's amazing.
It's all behavioral.
Yeah.
It's all the
costuming.
Dynamics that are displayed,
yeah.
Costuming.
And that's why at the end of the episode, I was like, I have no idea who any of these people
Which
are.
Which is very frustrating.
No,
that's my point.
To be fair,
like,
I mean, I was
pilot.
Thinking about that in terms of... They do have a certain advantage, which is that it all takes place in high school, which means that we all immediately recognize
There's
every
a
place. Every like you don't have to go. So here at this high school, we usually take English classes and social studies. Like it's just something that we are all instantly familiar with.
But do we? I think you're right. I think that
you didn't
is a
take
shortcut.
English at your high school?
No, we didn't do English, clearly. But is there the characters, obviously there were nerds in popular culture, but mm-hmm. Paul Feig sort of stated he wanted to do the kind of nerds that he was and his friends were, which is very different than the taped, you know, glasses
right.
Classic nerds. But also were there sort
lambda,
of
lambda lambda and omega mu.
We'll be doing that, even though this is a TV podcast. We will be. I think there was actually. Maybe we will be doing that.
Revenge of the Nerds show.
I'm certain there must have been. Yeah. I know there was a Delta House pilot that I think had Michelle Pfeiffer in it, if I'm not mistaken.
As Blutarsky.
That's right. It was very off odd casting.
That was it. Michelle, do it again.
But, so my question is, did we see burnouts on television prior to this point?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I definitely saw them when I was in high school, so yeah. I got it, you know? Immediately, I was like, oh, that's Mike. I won't even say the person's last name, but I knew
who. It might be a judge.
Yeah. So we go to the smoking patio. We meet in person more. We find out more about the burnouts, the freaks. Lindsay again is having trouble fitting in. She's like, yeah, I'm going to go to the dance. It'd be fun to go, right, guy? And they're just contemptuous of that.
Right.
Seth Rogen calls her Father Hitler.
Now, let me ask you about that, because yeah. that's a great example of the kind of jokes that the kids do in this thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, is that a good joke or is that a perfect, like, realistic teenager joke?
I think
it's, or is it both?
I think it's real. Like, I think that is it, because
is it like funny because it's like that is it a perfect thing that a kid would say that would be kind of nasty but also not a great, like, high level joke? But
right, that's what I was going to say, is like, that's the easiest reference to go to,
right?
And so that's the reference he's going to go to. He's not like a great joke writer. He's just like in the moment going, what is your father, the worst person I can possibly think of?
Right.
You know?
Which is why this is sort of genius, because obviously, you know, they were both stand-ups. Apatow coming, who he'd worked on Ben Stiller's show, mm-hmm. and Larry Sanders is where he kind of made his bones, and he learned, you know, it's and you could see the influence of Larry Sanders on this show in terms of casting and how you're structuring the show. And so they obviously could have written the best jokes you had ever heard.
Right.
They wrote them in a non-mannered, kind of very simple way that was true to the characters, which is what makes it even funnier, because you're laughing at the characterization and not the...
It says something about who that character is.
Right.
Not about... And this is a pet peeve of mine, and probably why I don't as much enjoy comedy pilots, is you don't hear the writers when the characters are talking on this show.
Right.
And I think in a lot of sitcoms, it's like, oh, I hear the writers patting themselves on the back for getting that joke into the script, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I love to pat myself on the back. I love to do a lot of,
well, that's,
you know,
why I so enjoyed working with
jokes.
You.
Was, right. Because, I was always like, yeah, this doesn't really show how smart we are.
What if instead of Hitler, we said, I don't know, Paul Pot's nasty cousin?
I'm certain we've both written Paul Pot jokes. The other thing I just want to note, since you were
just
touching
on... Just a funny
on,
name, Paul Pot.
Yeah. What, are we going to leave that on the table?
Come on.
Looking at, like, Seth Rogen and the sort of the meanness of that character,
yeah,
it's very interesting sort of having seen his persona now and obviously being probably close to who he is in real life and this sort of perfect amiable version of Seth Rogen. And I sort of found a quote that was him saying, at the time, I kind of had a chip on my shoulder, you know, because I hadn't gotten any girls to sleep with me yet. I was incredibly angry and repressed, and I think they saw me as this kind of weird, sarcastic guy and started writing towards that, but then they got to know me and saw me as a nice guy, and then that revealed itself as the show progressed.
Right.
Which is fascinating, seeing this early, because it really makes that group very threatening.
Uncomfortable, right. Yes. Well, because she goes, immediately they're like, oh, you're the girl who got an A in English class. And she's like, well, what are you going to do? Like, trying to play it down and not be the nerdy kid, which is very relatable to me, because I mean, that was the thing about Revenge of the Nerds is that at that time is...
You were one of those guys.
I was terrified that people would think I was one of those guys. It was such a phobia of like, I don't want the cool people to think I'm a nerd. And right. So she is in that position. She goes, what are you going to do? And Seth Rogen goes, I don't know. What are you going to do? Like, in other words, I'm not letting anything slide. I am going to attack you no matter what.
And were you one of the nerds?
I mean, there's different sides to that story. But yes, absolutely.
Me too. I was actually, there were no groups. I went to such a small school that there were no groups at all. So I was lucky that the cliques were cliques of like 3 to 5.
Well, I mean, I went so far as by junior year, I started playing. I was in all the shows. I was like, yeah, let's do Carousel. Let's do Guys and Dolls. And then by junior year, I was like, also, I'm going to play football because I want people to not think I'm just a theater nerd, you know?
You experienced a lifelong injury during that, right?
Well, yes. And I also still hold a couple of records for my high school in terms of receiving. I think I'm tied for first with least catches and least yardage.
Oh, good for you.
At 0 and 0.
I see the award on your mantle here.
It's not a good looking award, but it's on the mantle. Yeah. What are you going to do? When you get an award, you put it on the mantle, you know? Also, I had to get a mantle to put the award on.
Yeah. It's two people. Process. One person is missing a catch, and then there's a person behind him making a PU sign.
That was my coach.
Allotted.
So, but this is also the scene where we meet Millie, is that her name?
Yes.
For the first time.
Like, you don't know Millie's name.
Yeah. Well, she's the one I identify with the most.
Sure, sure. That's kind of probably the one I identify with the most.
But again,
it's not true because she was academically accomplished.
You just look at her and you immediately get who this character is.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Who else would cast her?
Yeah.
It cast any of the people in the show.
Right. And she is very focused on whether or not Lindsay is going to participate in the academic decathlon.
Right.
1980 was a big time for the decathlon because Bruce Jenner had just won the gold in the decathlon a couple of years before that. I think. I could be wrong about that, but I think it was right before that. So this starts Lindsay's whole thing with, I'm not going to do the academic decathlon. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
Right.
And Millie is very upset by that, doesn't understand how anybody could not desperately want to be part of the academic. I mean, she's their best mathlete.
Of course.
So then Cindy returns Sam's jacket. She's very kind about it, which to Bill and Neil means that she is in love with Sam.
Right.
Like, Neil is just baffled that Cindy would be seen in the hallway with Sam's jacket. Like, how is that possible?
And if I could touch on this for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
The introduction of Cindy Sanders is like, they see her coming from across the cafeteria. He says, there's Cindy Sanders. Dream on, Sam, because obviously already has a huge crush on her.
Right.
And then Bill says, incoming. They take the time. It's not like, oh, she just suddenly appears. They take the time for her to make that cross across the cafeteria.
Yeah.
There is no incidental music.
Mm-hmm.
What other show, definitely in the 90s, but I would say even today again, would not have some kind of, you know, heavy metal guitar riff, slow-mo of the actor?
I was going to say Sade.
Sade, yeah. Obviously, that would, of course.
Sade?
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 Certain I've pronounced it that way.
I mean, and we all know the Marquis de Chardin was a famous
and not to mention that, but of course, again, even this is the crush character,
right?
Cast by a character that absolutely could be out of your high school.
Yeah.
Instead of someone who's basically a 27-year-old playmate playing a high school character and dressed appropriately to that. And it's just,
you know,
no,
that Michelle Pfeiffer was the original casting for this.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
huh.
And then she got cast and she got
Pluto,
first position.
And
yeah,
like,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I mean, there was always a feeding frenzy over Michelle Pfeiffer.
What are you going to do? She eventually did the high school movie about the mines.
Dangerous Minds.
Yeah.
That yes. One. Which we also will not be covering because it's a movie.
Let's move on.
It was played by Natasha Melnick. But here's the other thing I was going to say about this is this plot in the show is like interesting to me because it is a show that leans so heavily on this is the alternative, this is going to be about their losses, this is going to be about their struggles, and even to the point where I think one of the biggest points of contention was when Scott Sassa. See, the one thing I'm confused about,
you're obsessed with Scott Sassa. Can
what
I just point
Scott
that
Sassa
out
up to now? I wish I could.
You're wearing,
just
I mean, that
Scott
T-shirt
Sassa
says "I heart Scott Sassa."
Look, I just feel like you know the guy picked up the show. He didn't interfere with the creative process. This is my kind of guy. Call me Scott. So I'm not sure exactly what, because he was a West Coast president, Garth Ancier, who came over from WB, and that was the person who had a lot of the biggest conflicts with Judd Apatow, according to Judd Apatow himself, and I believe the statement from Garth Ancier, which was the big point of contention, was can they get more wins? Can we see these characters get more wins?
Right.
And it's interesting to me because I think if you look at that particular plot, especially in this pilot, it's a huge win. This is a girl that he has a crush on.
I think both of them win by the end. Yeah. The whole pilot is about ultimately coming out on top, both of them.
So it's sort of, and I don't know if that was, you know, a concession they made for the pilot. And then they were like, well, now we're going
right.
to, you know, they obviously deal with a bunch of stuff that's hard on a pilot in terms of an audience. But it is interesting that was a specific
issue. A 15-year-old having an existential crisis about whether or not God exists.
I mean, if you want to get into this now, that scene is shocking.
Yeah, yeah.
It is shocking in terms of a pilot There's so much in that scene that is like she asks her grandmother, do you see a light? Do you see anything?
There
no.
is nothing.
Nothing.
There is nothing. But that's what they just that's leave what, it. But that's what.
And she's telling it to her younger brother.
Yeah.
To the point where his brain can't even compute it, and he's just like,
"Do you think I could beat up Alan or not?"
Situation with the bully. Getting back to that,
it's so great. Like, I love that scene. You know, because it is. It's like he can't. He doesn't even understand what she's talking about.
Grandma looked terrified and told me she didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's fucking insane.
Yeah.
You see God or light or heaven or anything.
We're trying to get nothing. Yeah, we're trying to get seven quadrants, including
this is,
people who have suicidal ideation.
This is the lead-off show. This is what you got in store. So let's stick around, huh? No, we're not going to do that. Give us one guitar riff when the crush showed up. Maybe we would hang around.
So Sam wants to know. He wants his friends to find out if Cindy has a date for the homecoming dance.
Yeah,
and this is where we meet a pivotal person in both of our lives, which is the character of Kim.
Busy Phillips. Kim Kelly, who Sean says that because the show that I created. You don't have to look it up. Don't go out of your way.
A pilot that Andy sold to UPN that ran for a number of episodes.
It ran for a full season. Give it its due.
22 episodes.
Love Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't think I have to tell you to don't bother looking it up because it's probably very hard to watch.
I was just trying to find the Barry Robot scene the other night on the internet and I couldn't find it.
That is one of my favorite scenes. Yeah. The Barry Robot scene being a scene that there was a lot of resistance to doing anything too broad. And we somehow got the person above me who was supervising the show to accept this because he was into like rich person robots, like, you know, kind of AI stuff, to get that one of the characters somehow got a bunch of money, adopted
a
robot.
Poker game. Yeah.
Right. He won in a poker game.
He won the money in a poker game and he bought a robot with the money.
And the robot basically was sentient. And at the end of the episode, when he says, "I'm sorry, I gotta let you go," the robot closes the blinds and his eyes turn red, implying that he's gonna
kill Barry. And just because I can't not talk about the robot, the robot was controlled by a guy who did the voice of the robot, and it's still my favorite voice ever in the history of television because the guy had a little bit of an accent, and so the way the robot talked was the robot would go, "I am sorry, Barry, I am going to have to bring you in." Like, he didn't have like a real robot voice. It was kind of halfway between robot voice and Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
So.
How did we get off on the robot? Oh, Busy Phillips.
Right.
This is where Busy Phillips tuned out. Like Busy Phillips will ever listen to this until we make her do the show. Anyway, Busy Phillips was the lead on Love Incorporated.
One of the leads,
and that's fair. Yes, mm-hmm. There were five. It's a pretty definite ensemble, and just, you know, everything you want Busy Phillips to be: a delight, a comedy, you know, surgeon, delivered anything you want to deliver, a friend, just great. And I was not a Freaks and Geeks diehard at that point, so I sort of knew of it. I'd seen it, and I think it was only later I really appreciated what a giant in television this show was. So it was in working with her that I came to appreciate how good she was, how she could do.
And doing a very different character.
Very different. And the rhythm that we wrote in was much more
sitcom.
Mannered sitcom. These are jokes.
I had a lot of great jokes that I patted myself on the back for in that show.
Without question. He would do victory laps around the writer's room, which were...
Not a big room, so it wasn't that hard.
Not a tasteful thing, to be honest with you.
So Kim shows up. Lindsay does not understand why Kim is being so mean to her. So Kim immediately is even more mean. Like, again, Lindy Cardellini as this confused person who's like, "What is happening right now? I'm allowed to be here," and Kim just dumps her purse on the floor.
And what's interesting about that is that it's not even stated what her issue is there. Like,
no.
You're immediately intimidated by her. You know what the dynamic is. Do you think it's clear in that scene that it's about territory and maybe something to do with Daniel? Because I feel like it's...
I think it's... If you know anything about high school, it seems fairly clear.
But that's the genius, is it's letting us connect the dots.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the only exposition that is stated in this show is Lindsay's backstory about her grandmother. Right. Everything else, which is in like essential to the theme, her thematic arc for why she is getting involved with the freaks in the first place, and to the arc of where she's going in the next several episodes.
Right.
Everything else is implied.
So next up, we have the gym class where Alan is going after, you know, the gym teacher tells them because of the homecoming game, they get the day off or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're going to play dodgeball. And of course, that's a nightmare for Sam. Sam stays in the game longer than anybody else, long enough to beat Alan at dodgeball. He catches the
another
ball.
Victory.
Yeah. A victory,
I don't know,
but
Judd.
But it's a victory, but a loss because
right. Well,
it makes him even angrier, and he's like, "You're dead." Or
that's
whatever.
Where it feels real is that with each victory, there is sort of a different.
It gets
element.
Worse.
Or it doesn't always get worse, but it's always like colored with something.
Right.
But before we're off the locker room, just like the line from Bill where he's sort of just standing there looking at himself, he's like, "These shorts aren't very flattering, are they?" How is that a line? What a great line.
Yeah,
like it's not a hard joke. It's so funny though. Mm-hmm. Martin Starr is—it's just the first episode. He
so
has
funny.
The comedic voice of that character, just razor sharp immediately.
We were watching the pilot, and after it was over, I had to watch again the scene of him watching Gary Shandling on TV by himself. It's
yeah.
just one of my favorite scenes. Such a sad, funny character. So they play dodgeball. Then we come up on the bleachers and kids are making fun of Eli, and Lindsay stands up for Eli. And of course, that goes horribly wrong.
Right.
Because Eli breaks his arm
and
blames Lindsay for it.
Right. Eli's hurt because he uses the R word and he says, "I'm special."
Yeah.
He's offended. She's trying to say, "No, they're really making fun of you." And then the perfect little icing on the cake is that one of the bullies is then, "Oh, I'm the mean one,"
yeah.
which is such a perfect
yeah.
like bully thing.
High school burn.
In the modern political spectrum or on social media
yeah.
to like immediately turn the tables in some weird way where it's like, "No, you're the asshole."
And then we come in on
it's
Mr.
Also,
Rosso.
Also broke my heart, by the way.
Yeah.
Again, I was immediately like, "No, don't hurt
yeah.
Eli."
Right. Funny.
Really bothered me.
So then we see Mr. Rosso.
As it should.
We think Mr. Rosso, the guidance counselor, is talking to Lindsay because of what happened with Eli. She thinks that as well. And it turns out he's just trying to convince her to participate as a mathlete in the academic. That's all he cares about.
Like, so great.
Yeah.
Another interesting that performance, you know, another one where it's, you know, Dave Gruber Allen,
mm-hmm.
who is Sean and I sort of remembered from the
Higgins Boys and Gruber.
Which Sean reminded me was a show on MTV,
yeah.
which is that really tells you where MTV, the network that you could argue built young, attractive people on television first.
It's responsible for everyone's obsession with being thin and pretty at this point. You know?
And it was the Higgins Boys and Gruber were one of the major sketches.
They were not young and pretty. They were young. They were not pretty.
But this performance is another
one. We're all
one.
Beautiful, by the way. But
sure,
go
of course everyone yeah. is, yes. Not Sean and I, but other people are.
Speak for yourself.
Fair enough. But the Mr. Rosso performance is such a perfect, like, it's sort of an awkward performance. And the reason I like it is because it kind of puts me in the mind of, like, in high school teachers have that kind of, they're not polished performers. They're like sort of awkward, sometimes broken people that there does look like there's just like a little bit of awkwardness in every move and every way they communicate.
And
something.
And that idea of like, "I want to be down with the kids. Like, I'm just like you," until the lines are drawn and you go, "No, you're in trouble."
Right.
You know, like he's being manipulative the entire time, even though he's going like, "You call me Jeff and I call you Lindsay.
Right.
I'm your friend." Nobody is your friend when you're in high school. That's
the sort of the theme of the show.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's not the theme of the show because, you know, everybody stands up for each other. And...
Right. But no adult is there to
no
help
you out.
No
adult is there. Yes.
You know? Okay. So then we come in on this new character that we've never seen before. But again, it's so easy to understand who this person is without any explanation, any exposition, because he's just a weird dude who's a little older who goes, "Ah, yes, the Cressman conundrum."
Yeah.
He's been through the same thing that Sam's going through, and he has the perfect solution for it.
That character was a guy who apparently they were overwhelmed with the amount of kids.
Uh-huh.
And Paul Feig says he feels bad about it because he just was just like, oh, we just got to pick out some and whatever. Uh-huh. And so he went into the waiting room. And he just was like, okay, I guess you come in, you come in. And then that guy was standing there is like, well, this guy's got a crazy look. All right, you go in. And they just built a character for him.
Yeah. And it worked.
It was perfect.
So he tells him, you got to fight your bully. And if you fight your bully, you'll feel good even if you lose.
Right.
And then he tells him that the guy broke his tailbone, but he got expelled. So it worked out great for him.
It's great.
Which, all you know, Sam only focuses on the fact that, or sorry, not Sam. Sam Levine's character, Neil, only focuses on the fact that it's violence and he does not want to be hurt. And then we see Lindsay and Ken. Ken wants Lindsay to cut class with him.
Right.
So they go off together. This is also, this next scene is...
Wait, I think Ken is Seth Rogen. Am I wrong about
that? Oh, no, you're right. You're right. I forget the other guy's name. The drummer.
Siegel. Jason Siegel.
Yeah. I don't remember.
We all know Jason Siegel.
Yeah. So he wants Lindsay to come off with him. We're back in the hallway with Sam where they're discussing fighting tactics and Sam sees Cindy down the hall and then accidentally makes eye contact with Kim, who basically seduces him in the hallway.
And then threatens him.
Uh-huh.
What do you make of that scene? I'm curious.
Well, here's
first of all, just amazing performance by Busy. They're just so threatening.
Yeah.
Like, that's hard to do, communicate that level of threat and have it feel real.
It feels to me like a...
That character's, the weird character's name is Harris Trinsky, played by Stephen Lee Shepherd.
Okay. It feels to me like that scene is really about establishing Kim's character.
Yes.
And also, you know, Sam being so confused by her sexuality in that scene.
Well, that's what's so... That really is a scene that's just like, could that be done today? Because right. that gets to the heart of like... And I think that was a stated intention of certainly Paul Feig, but I think everyone involved is in all... And everything up till that point, kids in high school were presented as like sexually confident. They wanted to get laid, whatever, as opposed to the, you know, the real terror that usually is involved in high school.
But to me, that scene pushes Sam further in the direction of asking Cindy to the dance because he's
interesting.
Like, I feel good about whatever's going on here, even though it was awful at the end. I was like,
sort of wake something up.
Yeah. He was like, oh, what is this? What am I feeling right now?
That's very interesting. Yes. I think that's reasonable.
So then we come back also, to
just the nuances of he is both threatened and kind of interested.
Right.
And then ends up threatened again. It's just so great.
Yeah, he doesn't know if he should just kiss her in that moment.
Not to mention what's going on in Kim Kelly's head of just like, just torturing this kid, but playing out some weird
knowing
thing
that
him.
He has no idea what's going on and she's just destroying his psyche. I will say, for me, it was seventh grade. There was a girl in eighth grade. I was on the bus with her. She's the prettiest girl in the eighth grade. And she said to me, we were on a class trip, and she sat down next to me, and she said, do you want to sleep with me? Would you be willing to sleep with me?
Yeah.
And I was like, Sam, like, I didn't even know what that meant at that point, you know?
How old are you at this point?
I was 13.
Yeah.
And
that's the age of John Francis Daly.
Right. Or he's a year older than I was at that time. Or
no,
two,
I think he was 13.
Years. He's supposed to be a freshman in high school.
Oh, I'm just saying.
Oh, in real life?
In real life. I think he was younger.
But anyway.
When he was cast, at least.
So I'm sitting there and I'm like, what does this person mean? But I'm intrigued and I, you know, she's so just stunningly beautiful in my mind. And then I look up and all the other eighth graders are just laughing around me because it was all a setup. So it was like exactly the same situation.
And so you're saying the real painful part of that memory is that now you can't use it in your own pilots.
No. What's cool is we did actually fuck on the bus that day.
Oh, well, it's okay. That's it. You got your win. Garth Antier would be happy.
But things got worse because she had a boyfriend. So in a way, the win was a loss.
It sounds like good writing.
Yeah. So, okay. Where were we? We were on...
Kelly terrorizing Sam.
Kim Kelly terrorizing... Oh, no. We're back at Jason Siegel and Lindsay at Jason's house.
Yes.
Looking at the drum set. And so this is a big moment for her.
Jason Siegel is Nick Andopoulos.
Right. This is a big moment for her because he says, you have to find your big, gigantic drum set.
Right.
Which is so funny. that he has the biggest drum set and he only needs a couple more drums and he'll have a bigger drum set than Neil Peart. Like, that is what makes you a great drummer, is how many drums you have in your drum set.
Sure, it's great. Kid,
and it makes him so happy. And he's like, you have to find your version of my drum set and figure out what makes you happy.
And what's also amazing about this is the complexity of, clearly, Lindsay is into Daniel. That's the crush. You have the weird relationship Daniel has with Kim Kelly, uh-huh. and how that plays out in such a tempestuous way. And then Nick is sort of pursuing Lindsay. And it's so high school and so like nuanced.
And it happens right from the moment he sees her on the smoking pad.
Right.
Like, there's an exchange there where he's clearly interested in her and thinks she's great. Which she is.
Lindsay?
Yeah. So
she defended Eli.
Then he talks about how he's going to come and get her so he can take her to the homecoming dance so she doesn't have to lie to her father. He's going to put on a suit. Like, he's just like head over heels at this point. You
right.
know? And then Mr. Rosso shows up and becomes manipulative again. That fucking asshole.
So as a former teacher, Sean, you didn't feel like you kind of saw where he was coming from.
No, I used to let my kids do whatever they wanted to.
Gotcha.
So she's going to be forced to work at the homecoming dance. She can't.
Right. And I was wondering if they were going to play it like she cuts the deal, but I guess she establishes. It's kind of nice even in that scene when he's like, well, can't you just lie to your father? And she's like, no, I can't. Like, mm-hmm. she's just like, she's not capable of it. It's
she's
really
still a good kid, even right. though she wants to be a freak.
Which, of course, leads into the conversation with Lindsay and her parents and Joe Flaherty freaking out and giving the amazing line, you can't cut corners with life. You know who cut corners? Kennedy, when running the Bay of Pigs, which you could argue that is a Pol Pot style joke. And I wonder if Flaherty wrote it, or if that was like an improv, or if that was originally in the
So this is where she calls him out, and it's just great because she's like, "What are you talking about? Like, you make no sense." And I love that because, like I said, he feels very cartoonish to me up until that point,
and that grounds it.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, I feel the same about this character as you feel.
And then in that moment, she leaves, and he is so desperate to get Sam's approval,
right?
You know what I'm talking about, right, Sam?
So beautiful.
And Sam is very torn about whether he should say yes or no.
What I love so much about that last moment with Sam, though, is it cuts to him, and that in any other show would be like, here's what I think about your opinion, Dad, or some crafted joke that Sean and I would work on for a very long time.
You know, you're no Pol Pot, but you're pretty great.
That's probably what it would be. Yeah. We'd love to work on Pol Pot in the first, you know, in any major episode of a podcast, you'll got to work in Pol Pot at least nine
times.
That,
I think, is the title of this episode, right?
Pol Pot?
Pol
sure.
Pot.
Yeah. Really, really pull a man.
Pol Pot and Freaks
and
Geeks.
Oh, Freaks and Geeks. Pol Pot. But anyway, Sam's response is just,
yeah,
that's it. That
he
is the joke.
He doesn't know what to say.
That's where it builds up to perfect delivery.
Yeah.
It's just, what is funny is the awkwardness of that character. Kind of like, I don't want to be in an argument about this, but I'm not, you know.
Not 100% on board. So that's when we get to the scene with Sam and Lindsay in her bedroom.
Right.
Where he just wants to know whether or not she thinks he could take Alan. And it's also, again, to go back to that idea of who's on your side, like, this is such a great scene because it establishes that they are both on each other's side, you know, that they're the ones who have each other's backs, because Sam says, I think it's the second line he has is like, why are you throwing your life away?
Right.
And it turns out that's what Millie wanted him to ask. And she gets mad about that. And then he goes, just because I asked you doesn't, or just because she told me to ask you doesn't mean I would have told her what you said.
Right.
It's like, it's just a great development of, like, they're looking out for each other, you know?
And it also shows, like, it has that sweetness, but it also shows the dividing lines of, like, Lindsay will defend him against a bully. She'll sort of say the nice thing at the end of, like, he's a goner when he asks, can we beat the bully? But she will also just be like, this is the thing that's bothering me.
Right.
This giant existential crisis. So I'm just going to lay it on you.
Is any of this worth anything?
Like, I'm just going to tell you that life is not worth living. Like, it's like, and that's just her own, a certain amount of narcissism and insensitivity. So it's like a perfect balance of, a good teenager that also has their blind spots.
And I just want to say one thing about something you said, which was the sweetness. And that's one of the things I love about the show is that it is so sweet. It is so sweet without ever being treacly or like purposely overwhelming or fake or like 90s sitcom. It just is, they're just, you like them.
I think that is really the heart of why this has become like this evergreen, this show that's immortal. I mean,
top
after
10,000, it didn't make the list.
I mean, I understand that one list, the top 10,000 shows that you're constantly frequenting and looking for your favorite shows.
It never changes.
And every time you state like, come on, top 10,000? You know, it's just like, is what you're saying. And I think it's not just the sweetness, but it's also that it's given to us in a realistic, organic fashion that we can believe.
Right.
Whereas...
Right, that's what it is. It's believable.
When it's this sort of engineered sweetness, you know, we might be on board, but at a certain point, the sort of the slack we would give a show like that runs out because it's just like, all right, well, you know, I don't really buy this as reality anymore. Right. Whereas this, it's like you buy any sweet moment because we've also seen this fucking horrible stuff happen to him.
And you know, that is one of the things that has always bothered me in shows that I even have worked on, of like sitcom writers going, well, this is how people behave. And it's like, no, it's not. It is not how people behave. It is how you think these people need to behave to serve your story. And in this show, they really do a good job of capturing the way that people behave. Thanks very much, everybody. Goodbye.
I should have stepped in and helped you because I saw something happening in your audience that way.
Okay, so now we're back to basically high noon. Sam and I keep calling him Sam because Sam Levine, but
it's a difficult part of breaking down the show.
Neil and Bill in slow motion walking to their showdown.
Right.
With Alan.
Two, by the way, again, Renegade by Sticks, which I had forgotten which is in it.
Yeah.
And it's just so, when I use that in something for myself, please don't judge me for it because it's so perfect.
Right.
I had no memory of that.
Right. And it's just such a funny moment of them like on their way to do what this guy told them to do, to fight Alan and stick up for Sam. And then Colin shows up, the other dude from the spiritual mentors, like the mentors, like they're literally, you know, when you read like old screenwriting stuff, it's like, and then the hero meets a mentor who shows him, you know, then Luke meets Obi-Wan Kenobi, and this is their Obi-Wan Kenobi is these two fucking idiots, and Colin shows up to say, here are all the ways you are about to die.
Yeah.
And then we have the sort of climax between the two of them. They wave because they think Sam is coming. It turns out it's Alan. Sam is still in school on his way to meet them to fight Alan. But he gets distracted by Cindy. Mm-hmm. So.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's almost to the level of, you know, Ferris Bueller turning back to say hello to the ladies as he's running home. But it's somehow so realistic that he's running, he doesn't care, and he sees her, and it's like, nah, it's just real, feels real organic.
Right, it's been building to this moment the whole time. He knows that his father, that's a hilarious thing also, his father is the biggest idiot in the world, but his father is the one who said, you always got to ask the, because nobody asks the prettiest girls to the dance, so you always got to ask him.
Right.
And Sam is like, well, that's what my father said, so that's what I'm going to do.
So let me ask you this, because this was the only thing, and I think it makes sense in the context that you're saying, of the father saying it, but there is a certain poise to Sam with this girl that he has a crush on, that I was like, it's very interesting that they play him that way, because he seems so rattled by everything. Do you think that's just a little bit of a, like, well, we got to buy that to move the thing forward? Did it feel real to you, is my question.
What part are you asking about? Like, which moment?
I think in general, like the first scene we see him, he can barely get words out to Cindy Sanders.
Right.
So it feels interesting to me that in this scene, he actually will go
But I think that's because of the stuff he goes through with Kim Kelly. Like he
and
has.
And that goes back to your other point.
He has
that,
learned
right?
from
and
this.
And you could
experience.
Argue the thing you're saying about the father, that there is this.
Yeah.
Yeah, this thing. You could also argue he's in motion, he's running to a bigger threat.
Right.
And so that might make this threat seem like more manageable.
Less significant. Yeah. So these guys are fighting Alan. Sam is asking Cindy. She says she already has somebody that's taking her, but she'll save him a dance. So it's this great moment of like, I didn't get what I wanted, but I got something. I did try and I got something out of it by getting her to say that she was going to save me a dance. Meanwhile, the guys who are fighting Alan is running away, telling them they're going to be dead.
Right.
Like he's retreating and going, you guys are dead.
So amazing. So amazing teenager characterization.
And then
like, doesn't drop the persona.
Right. And then they walk away. They're bragging to each other about how they kicked his ass. And then we're at the dance. We're in the resolution of the whole episode.
And this is what's amazing to me is like in the course of like, you know, 90 seconds, 2 minutes, you go to, first of all, there's this, again, going to Styx with Come Sail Away. Mm-hmm. You have Sam asking Cindy Sanders to dance. They go up. It's sort of the emotional part of Come Sail Away. And it's sort of that awkwardness of like, this is my first time in a slow dance with a girl. Then it kicks into the fast part.
Just when he gets there.
And what's interesting is that's more terrifying to him.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful because of course it would be more terrifying.
Right.
But it also allows you to, in an organic way, have it be more of a joyous kind of comfortable thing that then he's having fun.
Right.
Then you go to Lindsay sort of watching it and sort of her having a moment
Is any of this worth anything? I'm having an existential crisis. And then she looks over and sees Sam come in. Then she sees Eli dancing. And she's like, this is great. Like, this is fun.
What a fucking performance by Linda Cardellini in that moment. Her eyes filled with tears.
Yeah.
She is playing both the existential crisis and the joy of seeing her brother at the same time. This is at the beginning of her career.
She might have a future in this business.
I think you might be right.
Yeah, we'll see. Time will tell.
I'm going to cast her in something.
Yeah.
And then you go to, even as she's walking away, you wrap up Jeff saying, you should call me Mr. Russo. You tie up that plot. She goes and asks Eli to dance. The bully, you don't need to wrap up that bully plot.
It's done.
Making fun of them again. Kim Kelly punches him. That's another great performance by Busy at the end.
Well, I love that because it's her going, wait, maybe I don't have to be such an asshole all the time.
Right. You know? Just the
defending Lindsay in that moment.
The beginnings of cracking open that she might soften on Lindsay at a certain point. And in any other pilot, it would be her actually vocalizing it in a treacly way to Lindsay and Lindsay responding.
Right.
This is just, you can see with a look the possibility that they might be friends at some point, but you can buy it back instantly in the next episode if you want to, which I believe they do.
So Sam and Bill and Neil face their worst fears of physical violence and rejection. Nobody gets the bone in their nose sent through their brain. They're okay after the fight.
Right.
Sam doesn't get rejected completely. He gets something out of it. It all works out. He gets a dance with Cindy, even though it's not his date. Lindsay is having an existential crisis throughout the episode. And then by the end, she's totally exuberant as she dances with Eli. So I don't know what the fuck Garth Ancier was talking about that they needed more wins, because this whole episode feels like a big win for both of them.
Well, he came in later, so maybe it was once you get into the show proper, there's more like, can we go back to the pilot? But it is interesting because the pilot like was filled with wins.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you know, on the whole, a real stinker.
Yeah, I didn't care for it.
No, not a good pilot.
And it's funny that you're saying that, because I will say, I watched it last night and I watched it again today. And last night I watched it with somebody and we were kind of talking about it the whole time, so it was okay. Today I watched it by myself and I was bawling at the end.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I was shy. It is interesting for me to
folks, tune in every week to hear what makes Sean and Andy cry.
It is really interesting to me to see. It's because like the show is the same as it was the last time I watched it, but I reacted far more emotionally this time. Life's a roller coaster, is my point.
So anyway, thanks for discussing that with me.
Hey, Sean.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Okay.
I thought I was going to thank him too. I didn't thank him. He's lucky I'm here.
All right, so do we want to do this one last thing, or do you have anything else you want to say?
Just an amazing, amazing moment.
What do you think in
television
terms of
history?
What do you think about terms of, like, what's the A story, what's the B story? Like, we always talk about that in TV, right? Like, we need this A story and this B story, and we need beats for each of those stories. Well, how do you feel about that?
Well, this is another thing that's so interesting about how it's structured. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you got to give the A story to Lindsay, and you would probably say in terms of the weightiest theme, it would be her, you know, her existential crisis. But mm-hmm. you don't know about the existential crisis until halfway through the show. The only indication is that she's sort of clearly shifted away from her usual life in a sort of, you know, dramatic fashion. But right. we don't know why.
Right.
So it's such an interestingly, like, structured, lightly painted thing. Another thing that's sort of note that I had not mentioned is sort of the writing staff is filled with all of these ringers, most notably Mike White. And everything that came after that Mike White did is this style of thing, most recently The White Lotus, just like these turns of character and plots that are like, you're not sure where it's going because he's just following character the whole time. He's never following plot. But you would say the A story would be Lindsay. What do you think about the rest of it?
I don't know that I would say the A story was Lindsay.
Okay, well, I'm going to gather my stuff now and I'm going to leave.
To me, it reads as basically there. Well, it breaks down nicely because there's the Sam stuff and the Lindsay stuff. And
right.
those are the two, the freaks and the geeks. That's the two parts of the show. In my mind, there's four stories in this episode. There's Sam and his friends getting bullied by Alan.
Sure.
Which has a very satisfying climax. There's Lindsay being forced to go to the
dance.
Homecoming dance.
Right.
Which also has a very satisfying climax. There's Sam's romance with Cindy, mm-hmm. which ends up, you know, at the end. And then there's Lindsay's battle to not participate in the academic decathlon, which comes through all the way through and is something she's still refusing to do at the end, which pushes her further in the direction of being a freak. Like, she's refusing to concede to Rosso.
But here's what's sort of interesting even about that break, that very, very skilled breakdown.
Thank you.
Where you're wrong.
Yes.
But it's like, what about the Lindsay Eli plot? So it's sort of like, that's what's interesting about this is there's these paint strokes that they follow,
mm-hmm.
and then some of them turn into the whole plot where you wrap them up kind of at the end. And yeah, I guess you're right. Is there anything that is not
but
touched
I,
on? But
I would
that
argue
introduce?
That the Eli stuff is part of the Lindsay being forced to go to the homecoming dance plot.
But isn't it only that it has to do with Lindsay? You're splitting Lindsay having to go to the homecoming dance and what was the other? The mathlete thing.
The mathlete thing, yeah.
So if you're going to split those two, mm-hmm. don't you also have to split the Eli plot? Even though
I don't
it
think
also
so, because
Lindsay?
The reason she asks him in the first place is because she knows she has to go. And then things get worse. And he is pissed at her because she broke his arm and she feels badly about that. And then at the end, she ends up dancing with him at the homecoming dance.
See,
I think you're the one who's wrong here.
I can see that point, but it sort of points out the boldness of the way that they're telling stories is mm-hmm. that these things are branches that extend from the main branch. And so the argument of like, because I could argue if I was a very aggressive and contentious person.
Yeah, I don't want to get into like a Lincoln Douglas debate, you know.
If I was,
this is McKinley
Lincoln
High School.
Lincoln again,
you know.
Yeah. Always work in Lincoln anytime we can. Lincoln and Pol Pot, his two heroes. But you know, it's just sort of like that. I could argue that the Eli plot, you could even maybe connect it less to the dance part of it and more to the existential crisis part of it. That she's like, well, maybe there's meaning in this. Which is why she's so upset, like defending this powerless person. And that's why she's so upset in the scene with Mr. Russo that it's like,
okay. First of all, did you even watch it? His name is Rosso.
Mr. Rosso. I really undermined my point there. We'll have to edit this out. Which is, by the way, is another amazing thing about the show. You'll go, and me as someone who's like trying to break down the show, I'm like, oh, what was this character's name?
Yeah.
They very casually get to characters' names much later.
Which
they
I think
don't
is great because
do the network thing of like,
yeah.
here's my name and
which
here's
is
who
so
I am.
So unnatural. You
so,
never
but of
you
course
never call people
natural.
By their names in real life.
Oh, you're saying
Andy.
Yes. Right.
Secunda.
I hear you, Sean.
No, I see what you're saying. I always like to look at these stories in terms of structure. But the flip side of that is every episode of every show is its own thing and takes its own form. And so sometimes you just can't impose a specific structure on different parts of the show.
Right.
And this feels like one of those examples.
It would be interesting to go further and watch more of the episodes and then see if the structure changed.
So here's the last thing I want to ask you.
All right.
There were several other programs on television at the same time the night that this pilot debuted.
Programs, you say?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to read you the descriptions of the programs. You have to tell me two of them are real, one of them is fake, and you have to tell me which one is real, what the name of it is.
Okay.
And who the star is.
Okay.
This first one is this. The adventures of a man who mysteriously receives a newspaper the day before it is actually published, and he uses this knowledge to prevent terrible events every day. You have to say whether it's real or fake and give the title of the show.
Gotcha.
Here's the second one. The story of a beloved sea creature involved in rescue operations with the Coast Guard. Is it real or is it not real? Again, what I'm reading is not the title. It is the description of the show.
I don't understand.
Two best friends from Sea Caucus, New Jersey, move into a Lower East Side tenement filled with colorful residents. Okay. So
this is, yeah.
And that one actually is the description and the title.
Okay.
So just tell me which of those is real, what the names of them are, who the stars are, and what
Jesus
studio
Christ,
made them.
I'm not going to be able to do any of this.
I'll read them again. You tell me if it's real or fake.
Okay.
First one is The Adventures of a Man Who Mysteriously Receives a Newspaper the Day Before It's Actually Published and Uses This Knowledge to Prevent Terrible Events.
That is real.
Okay.
Because it's early edition.
Correct.
And it starred Christy Swanson.
Okay.
And
who was the guy?
It was Coach Taylor. I don't remember the actor's
name.
I'll give
you that
one. I'm a terrible
person.
One.
It was Kyle Chandler.
Kyle Chandler. Oh, wow. I'm doing better than I thought.
Yeah.
And the only reason I know that is because I was obsessed with Christy Swanson before she had a change of interests in her life.
Uh-huh. Okay, here's the next one. The story of a beloved sea creature involved in rescue operations with the Coast Guard. Real or fake?
I'm wondering if that's SeaQuest DSV. I don't know if the time is right, though.
So you're saying it's real?
I think it's real.
That is correct.
And is it Roy Scheider?
No. No, it is. It
connecting
is
him to Jaws.
Flipper, The New Adventures.
Oh, it wasn't SeaQuest.
No. And then the third one, obviously, is fake. Two Best Friends.
This was in 99?
Yeah. It was in like its third or fourth season at that point.
What was it called?
Flipper, New Adventures.
Crazy.
And can you name the star? And it's not Roy Scheider.
Give me a hint.
It's Flipper.
Oh, that was dumb.
Doesn't seem that hard.
I don't know.
Okay.
I thought you were.
And then the last
Who
one.
Who else was, is in it?
I have no idea.
Yeah, so Mr. Big Shot.
No. When I write the questions, I get to say whatever I want.
You sure do.
This
segment is let's make Andy look like an idiot. I feel like I came up pretty good with early audition.
The thing about Flipper New Adventures was they recast the entire show every season. Like Flipper was always involved with a new group of people.
He really was the star of the show. Yeah. And I've heard that's because he was very difficult and was just like, get rid of those people.
Well, they always told Flipper, never work with people or fish. So Two best friends from Sea Caucus, New Jersey, move into a Lower East Side tenement filled with colorful residents. That show is not real.
What's your pilot that you've written?
What is the title and who are the stars?
Let's see.
And you have carte blanche here because it's not real, so you can call it anything and you can cast anyone as two best friends from Sea Caucus, New Jersey. I would not cast Matt Damon and Ben Affleck because they already played best friends from Boston, but that's up to you.
Can we get them?
They're not doing
stars
right.
Freddie Prinze Jr.
Mm-hmm.
and Macaulay Culkin.
Great. I would watch that.
What else do I have to come up with?
The title.
Two best friends from Sea Caucus.
I say Sea Caucus because I think it's a funnier pronunciation, which is important.
Right. Then it is Sea Caucus DSV.
That is the actual title of my pilot that I wrote.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Oh,
all right. Well,
you're just trying to get me to title your pilot.
I didn't have one. I needed one. So this whole podcast was working up to that.
Fantastic.
Thank you for that. That's our show, folks. Thank you so much for listening. We will be releasing episodes of this podcast on the first and third Sunday of each month. going forward. So look forward to that. Also, follow us on social media at Co-Pilots TV. And if you're wondering where to watch the pilots that we're discussing, just check the show notes. We'll always have some indication of where you'll be able to find any of the pilots we watch, even the more obscure ones.
And you like our show? Or do you love our show? If you could give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, it would be incredibly helpful to us. We're a new, just sad and sweaty, struggling, failing podcast.
That's not how I see it. I think we're doing fine.
Okay, well, we each have our own perspective. And if you do give us that 5-star review, you will get your pilot's wings. We're also going to read a couple of these reviews in each episode to express our gratitude.
So you're going to send me wings in the mail, or how am I going to get these wings?
Oh, you're not. You know, we're not sending or doing anything. We're incredibly lazy. But you can print out your own if you want on a 3D printer, or you know, send away to some kind of mercantile company.
I don't even know what that means. What if I hate your show?
If you hate our show, Sean, you can also just leave us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and you're in. It doesn't matter what you write. You can write anything you want in the comment.
And you might read my comment even if I write something incredibly negative.
I mean, if it's funny, or, you know, if we're just feeling incredibly bad about ourselves that day, sure.
Great. That sounds fair.
So that's it. That's the end of our first show. Thank you all for joining us. We are coming in for a landing. I don't have our final sign-off catchphrase yet.